Hello and welcome to Technology and the Arts, a podcast exploring the connections between technology and art. This is your co-host, Brian Kelly. Episode 57 of the podcast features lightly edited audio from a live Google Plus Hangouts on Air that John Lemazney and I conducted October 15, 2012. In this installment, we discuss John's WordPress bootcamp at Princeton Public Library in New Jersey, as well as an artistic tool called Flame Painter. We also talk about Felix Baumgartner's 24-mile-high skydive, singer Sarah Brightman's preparation for a flight to the International Space Station, and interesting new discoveries about Stonehenge. All that and more is just ahead on Technology and the Arts, Episode 57. Enjoy. Welcome to Technology and the Arts. I am Brian Kelly.
I'm John Lemazney.
And we are here to explore the connections between technology and art once again. John, how you doing?
I'm doing well, Brian. How are you?
Doing great. What you been up to?
Well, tonight I'd like to simultaneously thank you for your patience and thank the audience that I had at Princeton Public Library. It was the first workshop that I gave in the library's technology lab, where there were not enough seats. And wow. This is partly due to the fact that they no longer require you to register in order to have a valid seat in the space. And so you have the wonderful problem of maybe not having enough seats for everybody. And we got together and talked about WordPress, WordPress.com specifically. We talked about WordPress.org as a concept, but we didn't get into the technology and art of installing WordPress on your own server. We spent enough time just sort of talking about WordPress.com, where it's a blogging engine originally, but now it's more of a content management system. Of course, it's the system that you know we use for our blog, and I use for about 12 other projects that I'm working on. And it's a fantastic tool. We have another week next week. And as I said, there's no registration. So if you're in the Princeton area at 6:30 and you would like to have a good, fun time talking about technology, why not stop up in the technology lab at Princeton Public Library next Monday, 6:30. And thanks again for your patience tonight. I know it's a late night for you.
No problem. You know, you're doing your speaking engagements out there in the community, so that's cool. It's funny you mentioned that.
It was very rewarding tonight to talk to those people, and many of them didn't know many of the concepts that we talked about, even the basics. So it was a lovely opportunity.
You know, when you mentioned WordPress as a content management system, it's funny with this web design project that I'm involved with. My job right now, you know, I was looking actually at companies that specialize in using WordPress as a CMS, and the companies that I had identified and tried contacting, they just dropped the ball. I mean, they never got back to me. And, you know, a couple of attempts to contact them, they just never got back to me, and this one company did, and then they wind up dropping the ball, like we were at the 5-yard line, and all of a sudden, you know, the designer stopped, you know, getting in touch with me to tell me what was going on. But
Ryan,
yes,
what's a yard line?
I'm sorry, football analogies don't work with you.
That's right.
It's 5 yards away from the goal line.
Oh, what's a goal line?
It's where you score.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, so we wound up going with this other company, and they built a site with a content management system, but it's a Joomla.
Yeah. You know, referring to WordPress as a content management system, as I did, is accurate. It's technically accurate. It does manage content, and it manages individual static pages in the way that content management systems must in order to be categorized that way. But unless your site is less than about 20 pages, it is not an effective content management
system. And that's where it would be good for my company's website because we do not have a lot of pages. We're not.
Oh, good.
Yeah, we don't do e-commerce. We don't do, you know, we just have a bunch of basically practice specialties, and we have a couple paragraphs about each thing, and you know that about it. And I really wanted the ease of WordPress instead of. I mean, Joomla is pretty easy, but WordPress is pretty. You know, I mean, of course, I've worked with it so long now, yeah. but I mean, it's still a relatively easy platform, especially compared to Joomla. And so now we're cutting ties with this design firm, and we just actually launched we just moved the website, the domain, over to the new website this weekend. So we have our fancy new site up, but in case something goes wrong, I did another search for web companies and found one actually in Bucks County which I didn't find the first time around, which I wish I did because they sound like a very decent company. I talked to a guy on a Friday and really responsive, and he was mentioning how Joomla at one point, like maybe even just a few months ago, was used on 70-80% of the sites that they built with content management systems, and now it's down to like 10%. And yeah, WordPress is now like 75%.
Joomla has lost a lot of its share, but mostly it's losing its share to Drupal.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Drupal is a far more sophisticated content management system than WordPress, also open source, and is really, if you're a web developer who's looking to extend their skills, definitely make sure Drupal is in your toolbox.
Right. You know, it's funny. They were talking about, you know, a lot of their customers were coming to them and saying, you know, I guess because they're familiar with WordPress as doing blogging, and now they know that it can be used as a CMS, they actually asking them to provide that service. And that was the reason for the flip, at least on their end, you know, for this company. So it's kind of interesting that people are specifically asking for it.
It's a lot easier to manage and upgrade and install than Drupal or Joomla. And that is not to say that Drupal or Joomla are difficult to install, but they're just, there's a lot more clicks to get the same thing to happen.
Right. But that's all I have going on my end. What do you want to talk about tonight, John?
Well, I know you have a couple items on the agenda, and I'm looking forward to chatting about those with you. Before we get into those topics, I just wanted to mention just an absolutely fantastic tool that is web-based. And the thing that triggered it for me was I was looking through wallpapers, and I like, just like everybody, I think, that when you look at your laptop's desktop or your, you know, desktop's desktop, to maybe inspire it a bit. And, you know, there are some really beautiful wallpapers out there. And very often as a graphic designer, I will look at something and I'll say, I wonder how that was made. You know, I wonder how that particular image was created. And sometimes you can tell exactly what was done, if it's purely graphic, or if you're familiar enough with the various tools, either vector tools or bitmap tools, you can piece together, you know, the layering that happened or the particular methodology that was used. But sometimes I'll run into images and have no idea how they were created. I mean, I can understand if they were created in a painterly way where somebody took a single pen tool and made 1,000 marks by hand, they could have come up with a particular image. But it's unlikely that they would have done that. And so that's part of the fun for me of looking at really beautiful abstract wallpapers is sort of piecing together how they were done. So anyway, I came across a tool that answered a question regarding some of these kinds of images, and I want to share that tool tonight. So I'm going to go ahead and share my screen. And I'm going to take you to escapemotions.com. There's an experiments section. And The name of the tool is Flame Painter. If we click on experiments, we can see that there's three experimental tools. The one that I'm going to focus on is Flame Painter, which also has a desktop version that you can go and pay for. But you see, as I move my cursor around, there's a really crazy cursor motion. There's all these settings down here for things like color and size and softness. And as I click and drag, you see how that...
Yeah, wow.
Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah.
And all I'm doing is clicking and releasing, and the rest of it's being taken care of for me. And if I move very slowly, you can see it becomes much more intense. And if I move very fast, you can see that it becomes more fluid, like smoke. I can change the color, for example. And if I want to start over again and try something very specific, like that, I mean, that literally looks as though something's burning and there's some smoke coming up from it. And it's such a simple tool to manipulate. I only wish that it was open source.
Right.
And it is Java-based, though. It's Java's required. If we go back to experiments, I just want to go back to some of these real-time motion effects. You can see that there's some really crazy things that you can do with some of these tools here. And Peter Blazkowicz is apparently the designer of a lot of these Java experiments. So I just wanted to bring light to it and share a little bit about this really beautiful, simple tool for creating these kinds of images.
Thank you for that, John.
You're welcome, Brian.
Anything else on your end, or?
No, I think I'm satiated.
Well, I just wanted to, not sure about the artistic angle, although some of the images that we saw yesterday from it were amazing. But I just wanted to, you know, talk about Felix Baumgartner's 24 miles skydive yesterday.
I have not actually seen the video yet.
Oh, you should take a look at it.
I'm sure they will.
Here he is. It was about 128,000 miles up. 128,000 feet up. You know, the balloon that takes the capsule up, and there's cameras out there outside the hatch, and he gets out and he's sitting there. I mean, with the world beneath them, it was just this amazing image, just sitting there at the edge of this capsule door. You know, and it's like he can't go anywhere else. I mean, he has to make this jump at this point. I mean, it really was jaw-dropping. And when he took that step off, and like the camera was above him, and he just sank. I mean, so fast, and it literally left you breathless for a second, or at least it did me. And then, you know, when they got the video of him and he starts tumbling like out of control briefly, and there was one point where my heart sank because you heard him breathing and then you didn't hear it anymore. And you see this figure just tumbling out of control for a little bit. And I'm like, and then they cut to the control room, the mission control room, real quick. At least it looked like to me, and I'm like, uh-oh. But then all of a sudden you hear clapping, and, you know, they got good readings on him. He stabilized, and, you know, and then he landed on his feet. I mean, it was amazing, and he wound up, or at least they're saying now, I mean, they have to verify it officially, but his team claims that he reached 833.9 miles per hour, which is Mach 1.24, so he became the first human outside of a spacecraft or aircraft to break the sound barrier. And he did fall short of the fall record, though, because even though he had a longer free fall, because he was higher up, he actually was able to generate more speed. And because of that, he went up a few seconds short. He opened his chute a few seconds short of the time element for the longest free fall. So I guess it was the furthest or farthest free fall.
Who held that record?
Actually, he was the Capcom for the mission. Kittinger, back in 1960. I mean, it's amazing.
Is there a video of that too?
There's a photo of him jumping from
probably not the same viewing experience.
No. It wasn't on YouTube.
Right.
But if you go to Red Bull Stratus, they talk about RedBullStratus.com. They talk about his jump, and they show the picture of him. And what was actually weird about that is during the webcast yesterday, they were talking. He actually tore his glove during, I guess, the flight checks, and didn't tell anybody because he didn't want the mission scrubbed. And here he is at the edge. I mean, he could have died. I mean, his hand actually, they said his hand when he got back down the surface, it's swollen up to twice the size.
Wow.
And obviously the 24 miles was a record. But the thing that a lot of people just looking at the thrill seeking element of it, but there was a science component, and that was, his medical director was Jonathan Clark, whose wife Laurel Clark was one of the astronauts killed in the Columbia breakup when it broke up upon reentry back in 2003, I believe. And so he's using the data from yesterday's jump as part of his work to come up with some kind of survivable suit or some kind of survivable mechanism for astronauts to escape a high altitude disaster. So,
wow.
there is a benefit to to this jump, but it was amazing. And some of that image of him just sitting out there, it was one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. It was so crystal clear, too. I mean, it was just amazing. And similarly, another bold step into space is Sarah Brightman, who originated the role of Christine Daae in Andrew Lloyd Webber's Phantom of the Opera back in the 80s, is preparing for a trip to the International Space Station for a 10-day mission. And she plans to be the first Playbill.com stories claims that she's going to, wants to be the first professional singer, obviously to sing from space. And this is all part of her role as a UNESCO artist for peace. And, she's going to advocate UNESCO's mandate to promote peace and sustainable development to safeguard our planet's future, quote from the Playbill story. So, she's going to be on a 10-day mission aboard the ISS. Again, it's not known when it's going to take place, but she's currently in training, and she's going to, go as a tourist aboard the Russian Soyuz spacecraft. So good for her. And that's pretty, pretty kick ass.
That's amazing.
So,
I didn't know she had it in her.
Yeah. I saw it. I was like, Sarah Brightman. But she's passed all the initial tests, and, they say she's good to go. I mean, she's, and it's funny, you go to her website now, and it's all about her training. It's nothing about, there's stuff about singing, obviously, but it's really focused on her training right now, and it's really fascinating.
That is fascinating. It's surprising.
Yeah. So I guess the last thing I wanted to was, and this is from the Daily Mail out of the UK. It was apparently some researchers took some high-resolution 3D laser scans of Stonehenge and found that there are these intricate carvings, a lot more than previously known or expected. Basically, like, almost every stone has these carvings, and they also saw through these scans that the stones were actually worked differently. Layers were taking off in certain places, and when they put it all together with the way that the stone was worked, the carvings, the location of the stones, the alignment of the entire structure, with the lighting at the the midwinter sunset, and they kind of feel that a lot of the alignment and structure of Stonehenge was basically to serve as an art gallery. The light reflected off the stone, which was made very reflective through the work that was done on them, and it would glisten off the carvings when the light from the midwinter sunset was at certain angles. So it's kind of cool. They just talked about how it really took some intricate calculations and studied it to get the desired effect. So it was a cool thing, and I'll put a link in the post once the archive version of this webcast goes up.
This brings to mind a project that I had. Of course, my undergraduate is in sculpture. I have a BFA. And not only my undergraduate, but this was during my pursuit of an associate's at Bucks County Community College. We had a sophomore seminar class. And one of the projects in the seminar class was a ancient artwork, and the limitations of the piece were that you could only use techniques and materials that were available to you 10,000 years ago, which was sort of an arbitrary number. And at first it's like, oh, well, I'll just, stack some wood into a sculpture. At least the way that I typically worked was I thought about a problem in terms of what's the simplest way that I could answer this problem. And then you start to build on it and say, what's a more sophisticated way that I could represent myself and follow my muse and whatever. But it was such a difficult problem because if you wanted to connect two pieces of wood, you couldn't use a nail. You couldn't use glue unless you made it, or unless you made the nail and made the hammer. Right. You couldn't do any cold joinery because you didn't have a saw. Simply sort of stacking something together was kind of lame. And, you couldn't use metal, because you would have to smote it or, cast it. And there were a couple people who tried some things like with fire, but what we found generally was that we were mostly disappointed with our effort because it was so difficult comparative to the way that artists work today, where you go out, you buy your materials, you bring them back to the studio, you make whatever. You drive it from place to place. Like, that was the other thing. We had to bring our piece with us, not by wheelbarrow or anything. Like, we had to carry it or make some contraption to get it there.
Huh.
And it was sculptural rather than painterly. So it wasn't as though, like, we could have done a drawing on paper, but we had to make the paper. And the way that paper is typically made is with screen, but you'd have to make the screen.
Right.
You know, it was a really interesting problem and probably one of the most challenging things I've ever had to come up with a good solution for. And then you think about something like Stonehenge.
Yeah.
Where it's a mystery for a reason.
Yeah.
But also the great amount of effort in something like that, or the pyramids, or, you know.
Yeah, it's funny. Doctor Who reference. In the episode The Pandorica Opens, they go to Stonehenge. And, you know, this is at the time when the Romans occupied England. And Amy Pond, the companion, mentions, like, oh, well, wouldn't it be new? Like, you know, time travel is like, wouldn't it be new? Why is it old? And River Song, who's another sometimes companion, says it's already old. You know, even back then, it was already old. And so it's kind of amazing when you think about it.
Yeah.
How ancient and amazing it is.
Agreed.
So I guess we can make this real quick tonight. The one last thing, I guess, I threw up this morning one of those in perspective.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear it.
Of what? No, I know.
You threw up this morning?
No, I threw up on the blog.
Oh.
Which, yes, I did throw up. No. I posted an In Perspective segment. And I actually, the reason why I hadn't done one last week is because I couldn't figure out which one to do, which song to post. And I decided to go back and revisit probably the first complete song. I'd written some things before, you know, but I mean, as far as having complete lyrics, a complete song, a complete arrangement, this song was probably one of my first, if not the first. It was written back in October 1989, I think. I used to think it was 88, but I recently thought about it some more, and I realized I don't think that makes sense because of the lyrics are actually deal with something that would have happened during the summer of 89. And it was funny, this guy I worked with at the time in a restaurant, not really fast food, but kind of like one of those in between fast food and sit down places. And
we're talking about a Chi Chi's.
It was a Pizza Hut.
Oh, Pizza Hut. That's not fast food.
No.
It's not good food, either. But yeah. It's not fast food.
It's not good, fast, and we didn't help make it fast either. I mean,
it's not good, fast, or cheap, actually.
No. And
have you ever heard that saying, you can have it good and fast, but not cheap, or good and cheap?
Yeah, you can get it any of those ways. Yeah. So there was this guy who worked there, pretty much as a simpleton. He was like, he had an Archie Bunker mentality. I mean, he's not somebody who really opened up a lot, but he had this summer fling with this girl who worked with us this one summer, who actually was the sister of somebody I went to high school with, and for a brief time I was actually kind of close to him. But so they had this fling, and then she went back to college, and wound up going to visit her, and realized that that's when it hit him that it was just a summer fling, and she was okay with wanting to still be friends, but that was basically it. And it hurt him, and I didn't expect this. So it was slow one night, and he was just, going on and on about this. And I was like, wow, this is like really interesting that he's opening up about this. And I use that whole conversation to write the lyrics. So it's about, it's kind of a lot of the stuff he was expressing. So it's one of the few times I've actually written lyrics. Actually, a lot of my lyrics aren't personal either. they're just kind of phrases that come to my head and I try to, finish them off. But, some of them are, but I guess a lot of them are, but this was the first time like I wrote from somebody else's perspective. And it's kind of weird because, I mean, that was the first real set of lyrics I wrote, I had ever written in, and it didn't really involve my point of view. But it's like, it's one of my oldest songs, and every now and then, every few years, I decide to, ever since I started working with GarageBand, I've kind of gone back and updated it. And it's funny, even today, the original recording, even though I used old equipment and there was just a magic in when it went into the bridge and that combination of sounds, I've never been able to replicate that. I'll never capture that particular magic again, but I still think it's a pretty good song. I don't know if you want to call it up or no.
Yeah, sure.
So those techno drums in the background are new. I don't know if you want to fast forward to the towards the middle where it kicks in. Yeah, right there. So on that version, now you can stop it. On that version, I decided to do some experimenting with my vocals and played around with the harmonies a bit, which I had never done on that particular song before. But I mean, I know it's a little boy bandish, but in fact, I was only 17 or 18 when I wrote that. I think it's a pretty damn good song for a 17, 18 year old.
Agreed. You have quite a portfolio of songs, actually.
Yeah.
What?
They're not very good, but...
Stop.
But yeah, for someone who doesn't really do music, I do have quite a number of songs. someday I'll do something with them. I'll give him the gram. He'll re-record them and make a living out of it, I guess.
That sounds like a good idea.
Yeah.
No pressure, Greg.
Yeah, well, either that or, be a baseball player.
don't do that.
We'll see. We'll see what he wants to do.
We'll see. Like, so, Greg, agreements to do.
So that's really all I have.
Yeah, so thanks again for letting me share that particular tool. I've known about that tool for a while and was really glad that I got a place to share it. I think that a lot of people are looking for that kind of specialized thing to make a very specific kind of image.
Yeah, I know. It's really cool. I'd really love to play around with that thing. So
yeah.
And what was it again? That was a flame.
That is escapemotions.com. under experiments. The experiment in question is called Flame Painter.
Flame Painter. I will put a link in the show notes for that.
Cool. Hey, Brian, thank you so much.
Thank you, John. Take care. That concludes this episode of Technology and the Arts. For more information about the podcast you have just heard, please visit technologyandthearts.com. Like us at facebook.com/technologyandthearts. Follow us on Twitter at @tech_arts. And subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/technologyandthearts. Thank you for listening.